From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the history of lynching in America. We hear about the perpetrators, the individuals who took a stance against it, and the legacy it left behind. Our guest is Philip Dre, author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Keep That Groove Going, the new recording featuring saxophonist Plaz Johnson and Red Holloway. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Congress reconvenes this week, and Enron will be at the top of the agenda. Two congressional panels are holding hearings on Enron Thursday, with at least six more hearings expected in the next 3 weeks. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
10 panels in all have their sights set on Enron, its auditing firm Arthur Andersen, and the regulatory system that failed to anticipate Enron's collapse. That seems to be at least as many committees as were investigating Clinton administration scandals at any one time. One significant difference, the Clinton probes were all partisan, a Republican Congress investigating a Democratic White House. This time, the Democratic-controlled Senate and the Republican-controlled House are both aggressively pursuing Enron. Another difference, campaign cash. According to an analysis by NPR and the Center for Responsive Politics, all of the investigating senators and all but 12 investigating House members took campaign contributions that trace back to Enron, Andersen, or Citigroup, Enron's biggest creditor. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
The military prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, received a group of injured prisoners from Afghanistan today. The group reportedly includes some prisoners on stretchers who will be treated at a newly set up field hospital. Human rights groups have been urging that the prisoners be classified as prisoners of war, a status that would give them protection under the Geneva Convention. A judge in Los Angeles agreed today to hear a petition from civil rights groups demanding that the status of the prisoners be clarified. That petition is scheduled to be considered tomorrow. Israeli troops have taken over the Palestinian-occupied town of Tulkarm on the West Bank. Israel calls it a reprisal for a Palestinian attack last week that left six people dead. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is angry. The BBC's James Reynolds reports from Tulkarm.
Yasser Arafat has said that this raid crosses all the red lines in the conflict. But Israeli officials stress that they have to be here in order to protect Israel from further attacks. Israeli officials also say that this reoccupation isn't for good, but on the ground here in Tulkarm, Palestinians have a different impression, as they, like me, see tanks just within a few meters of them, rolling by and setting up in positions.
The BBC's James Reynolds reporting from Tulkarm. So far, donor nations meeting in Japan have pledged more than $3 billion for reconstruction in Afghanistan. Interim President Hamid Karzai told delegates at the Tokyo conference that his government needs immediate funding to pay for basic services. The United States pledged $296 million in aid for this year, with a promise of more to come. U.S. stock markets were closed today for the holiday. This is NPR News. The family of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. urged Americans to use today's holiday as a day of community service. The civil rights leader's widow, Coretta Scott King, spoke at a memorial at Atlanta's Ebenezer Baptist Church, where King was once co-pastor with his father. The new mayor of New York City marked the holiday by reaching out to black New Yorkers who felt shunned by his predecessor. Beth Fertig reports from member station WNYC.
Mayor Michael Bloomberg attended the Reverend Al Sharpton's National Action Network for a Martin Luther King Day tribute. The new Republican mayor got a standing ovation as he entered the crowded room in Harlem. Bloomberg's predecessor, Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, refused to meet with Sharpton. The former mayor also had low approval ratings among blacks who didn't trust his aggressive policing strategies. At Sharpton's event, Bloomberg said he hoped the best days are still to come for all New Yorkers. Earlier, he held a breakfast at City Hall for community and political leaders, including former Mayor David Dinkins, the city's first black mayor. He also praised Dinkins at an event in Brooklyn where Giuliani was once booed on Martin Luther King Day. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.
Tomorrow marks the 29th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision in which the Supreme Court legalized abortion. Activists on both sides of the issue are planning to use the occasion to mobilize support for their legislative agendas. They're particularly interested in motivating voters who will choose all 435 House members and 36 senators in this year's elections. The National Association for Women says it will hold a prayer vigil in support of abortion rights outside the Supreme Court. The anti-abortion activists are trying to build on the gains they made this year. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, seeking to improve people's lives by supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and child abuse prevention.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. In 1967, Dr. Martin Luther King wrote, "It may be true that the law cannot make a man love me, but it can keep him from lynching me." For many decades, however, the law did not protect African Americans from lynchings. Starting after the Civil War, thousands of blacks who were accused of or merely suspected of crimes were hunted down, abducted from jails, and executed by vigilante mobs. In his new book, At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America, Philip Dre examines the history of lynching from the late Reconstruction period to the 1960s. Dre is also the co-author of We Are Not Afraid, about the murder of three civil rights workers in Mississippi in 1964. While working on that book, Dre visited the Tuskegee Institute, where he was given access to its lynching archives. The material there was a revelation to him. Terry Gross spoke with Philip Dre earlier this month.
What do you think is the importance of understanding the place of lynching in American history?
Well, I found that in researching the book, the place of it in American history was even deeper than I had anticipated, in that I had suspected, of course, that it was a very powerful influence on black Americans in the years after the Civil War and into the 20th century. But what I found was that it was not only a very intense psychological influence on black families. For instance, the way they would raise their children. You wouldn't want to raise your son to be particularly ambitious or bold for fear that he would attract the attention of a lynch mob. Secondly, it forced families to migrate. Lynching was so endemic in various parts of the South around the turn of the century that it contributed to the northward migration of about 1.5 to 2 million blacks. Of course, that's a famous thing in American history, called the Great Migration. It also created a lot of reform efforts, that things that are very familiar to us, like the NAACP, which was for many years, of course, the largest and really only black civil rights organization in America, really got off to a start because of lynching. It was in reaction to a riot in Springfield, Illinois in 1908 that had started because of a lynching, that progressive whites and blacks came together and said, we have to get together and do something about this. And indeed, the NAACP made fighting lynching one of their top priorities for many years, well into the 1940s.
In Westerns, both in, you know, the real life of frontier towns and in the mythological life on TV Westerns and movie Westerns, there were a lot of lynchings of white people. And I'm wondering if you see that as a completely different kind of phenomenon as the lynching of African Americans in the South.
It was certainly related, in that lynching was always meant to be, it came from a very old tradition in America that dated back to the Revolutionary War. In fact, lynching, the term, derives from the Revolutionary period when a magistrate in Virginia named Charles Lynch began, because of the war, the activity of the ordinary courts had been suspended. And so he took to administering summary justice in his front yard by administering floggings against a large chestnut tree. So the term lynching derives from that. It always meant a denial of due process. And of course, it was considered quite legitimate for many years, particularly in the West, where it was seen as almost a civic duty that this was the way in which a kind of unruly area was tamed, and miscreants of various sorts, gamblers and con men, were removed from society. So it had a very kind of almost a noble reputation for many years. In the South, though, it began to sort of go off onto a different avenue, in that it, in the Reconstruction era, it became used as really a way to kind of keep down blacks who were either active politically or increasingly, as years went by, socially. Those two things really kind of broke off from one another. And by around the 1880s or 1890s, lynching of whites began to decrease, whereas the lynching of blacks increased.
What were the justifications that white people in the South used for hanging black men? I mean, it's not only taking justice into your own hands, but it's doing it in an incredibly cruel and hideous way.
Right, and it wasn't only hanging. It was some of the more spectacular lynchings were actually immolations. But, of course, hanging was also common, as was just shooting. The chief justification, or the most sensational one, was the rape of white women. In other words, this was a very hot-button sort of issue, and it was one that would never fail to inspire a lynch mob to form. So very often, this was used, even in cases where there was no real basis for it. That reason was often given as to why the men of the South had to protect white women and therefore protect the white race, really. It had to do with a kind of destabilizing atmosphere that came in the 1890s. It's a little mysterious because lynching was a kind of a mass hysteria, really, and so it's hard to really point to the reasons, except it was a period in which the first generation of blacks who had not been slaves or born in slavery were coming of age, and the white South was under assault, really, in many ways, from not really knowing how to deal with this minority population in its midst. At the same time, white women were entering the workforce, working in textile mills, that sort of thing. And so there was a kind of pressure placed on white men to kind of hold on to the status quo. And many scholars feel that that is what triggered this kind of hysteria of seeing black rapists lurking behind every tree, basically.
In the book, you use the expression Southern spectacle lynchings. You say that this type of lynching emerged in the 1880s. What do you mean by that expression?
Well, spectacle lynchings are kind of the most well-known, in that, just like the name implies, they were huge events, really some of the largest public events held in the South for many years. Typically, a black man would be accused of what they used to call sexual outrage, which could mean anything from rape to just looking the wrong way at a white woman. He would then be, with the complicity of the law, he would then be taken from jail, and when a large crowd had assembled, led to a spot that had been preselected for it, allowing the best viewpoints for the audience, and then tortured, mutilated, set afire. And these could be almost like day-long events, almost picnic-like. So that's the term spectacle lynching comes from that.
What have you found out about who participated in lynchings, who organized them?
That's a very difficult thing to say. As the title of my book, At the Hands of Persons Unknown, implies, At the Hands of Persons Unknown was almost invariably the coroner's verdict when a lynching victim was found. It was a euphemism that basically meant to suggest that no persons had really committed the crime of lynching, but rather it had been an expression of the community's will. So this researching who the perpetrators of lynchings were is very difficult, because the purpose of lynching was to obfuscate things that ordinarily in a trial would come out, say in a trial transcript or lawyers' arguments or an interrogation that was recorded, that sort of thing. So you're left really with a lot of just kind of reading the tea leaves. Generally, from just anecdotal evidence, mostly provided by newspapers, most lynchings, you get the sense that it was they were led by sort of a inner circle of firebrands who were rousing everyone up. There were usually many, many young men involved, boys from the age of 10 up. And then beyond that, you had sort of the rest of the community that might not really approve, but didn't want to miss out on it. So it really, they really were like community events. It's not uncommon to read newspaper accounts of lynchings in small towns where it's reported that every citizen in the town was there.
Is there anything like this that you can find in American history, like the kind of lynchings that became public spectacles and public events where everybody showed up, maybe brought a picnic lunch, and you know, watched it like it was a movie or a theater event?
I can't really think of anything. Probably the closest thing is a religious revival, you know, an outdoor religious revival. In the South, for instance, we've all seen these kind of things depicted in films where, you know, the families show up and it's a day-long event and people get very carried away. It's a very emotional experience. I mean, it's important to point out, too, that lynching itself was in many, especially with spectacle lynchings, was a kind of quasi-religious experience because it was so ritualized and it seemed to suggest a kind of expiation on the part of the lynch mob. In other words, often lynchings would follow a period in which white and black relations in a particular community had become very tense. And so the lynching served as almost a kind of a release, like a sacrifice. Meanwhile, of course, you had the Southern white population still sort of reeling from the Civil War and lashing out at the people, namely blacks, who they saw as the cause of this dilemma. So it was a kind of a catharsis, a sense of release, and it was important to completely destroy the victim because it was believed that if you completely destroyed a person and left really no part of them extant, they wouldn't go to heaven. And so you'll find that in most lynchings, not only was the person killed or immolated, but then what remained of them was cut up and handed out as souvenirs.
Were there other ways in which hangings were ritualized?
Well, not all lynchings were spectacle lynchings. In other words, there were another type of lynching called an underground lynching, wherever lynchers felt that they couldn't operate quite as freely as in other instances with the approval of the community. They would operate much more secretly. And, you know, typically a victim would be abducted and taken off into the swamp and never seen again. But there was a lot of ritual in terms of, for instance, you know, a certain length of time would often have to transpire before the lynch mob was expected to show up at the jail. You know, maybe a decent interval to sort of allow the lawmen to pretend that they had control of the situation. There was often a kind of a ritual with the family of the person. There was the family that had the strongest grievance against the black person would be allowed first opportunity to either mutilate or torture or even kill the person. This was considered a rite that even the most unruly lynch mob would observe.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Philip Dre. He's the author of the new book, At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Philip Dre is my guest. He's the author of a new history of lynching in America. It's called At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. In the cases where there were big spectacle lynchings, where everyone in a small southern town would show up to watch the event, almost like a spectator sport, wasn't there any way of stopping it? Were there any laws that made lynching illegal?
Generally, anyone who tried to interfere with a lynching was either ignored or told to go home or even abused in some way. It was just too overwhelming an experience usually that you really couldn't stop it. There were state laws passed against lynching in various southern states, usually as a way to try to stem the flow of emigration by black laborers. In other words, at the level of, say, the governor and prominent businessmen, they might view lynching for what it was, which was a force that was driving needed labor away. And so they would act to stop it. It took a very long time, though, at the local level, for people to start resisting lynchers. In other words, it was more common at the federal level and at the, like say, the state level of state government to express concern about it. But there was a long, long debate about what to do, actually what to do about lynching, partly because of what I mentioned before, which was there was a very popular idea that a local community knew what to do with criminals in its midst and that they should not be interfered with.
Let's look at some of the opposition to lynching. You write a lot about Ida B. Wells and how she became an anti-lynching activist. And you quote something very eloquent that she said, "No other nation, civilized or savage, burns its criminals. Only under the stars and stripes is the human Holocaust possible." What was her approach to trying to stop lynching?
Just as the quote you read suggested, she was outraged about lynching, and she was really the first anti-lynching crusader to appear. She got involved in 1892. She was a journalist in Memphis, and three of her friends who ran a grocery store were lynched because their business was threatening the business of a competing white grocery store. And so when that occurred, she realized that the rationale about black rapists threatening white women was really just that. It was just like a rationale or an excuse because these friends of hers had been perfectly legitimate businessmen. She began editorializing about lynching and researching lynchings herself in the South. And for her trouble, she was driven away. Basically, a mob trashed her newspaper office and warned that if she ever came back, she herself would be lynched. So she moved to New York and went on a kind of about a 15 or 20 year international crusade, both in Britain and the United States, lecturing and writing about lynching. All she could do really was try to bring it to people's attention. In other words, at that time, many of these events occurred in the South where news of these events didn't necessarily always come out, or by the time it did, it was so shaded against the person who had been lynched that there wasn't a great deal of sympathy in America for the victims. So what Ida Wells was trying to do was basically call attention to what an outrage this was and get some coverage of it, get people alarmed about it, and try to sort of change the dynamic so that the lynchers were the criminals, not the victims.
What were some of the disagreements among African-American leaders about what to do to stop lynching?
Probably the most famous disagreement was between Booker T. Washington, who was a famous Southern educator, and of course, at the turn of the century, the most powerful and popular black leader in America. Between him and W.E.B. Du Bois and first the Niagara Movement and then the NAACP, which Du Bois helped found, basically it was an argument that while Booker T. Washington certainly did not condone lynching, he tended to believe that it was a fate that mostly befell criminals or outcasts, and that it would be too much of a distraction to really mount protests against it. Whereas for Du Bois and Ida Wells and many others, they saw it as really this form of caste oppression that was very dominant and that had to be met head on. It's kind of a telling thing about that period that even though there were a lot of other issues that should have been on the table, like the disenfranchisement of black Americans, that those issues were not really being discussed. But lynching was an issue that was so sensational that it did create a dialogue in the newspapers. It was something that was so egregious that black reformers could get white people's attention, especially in the North, obviously, to discuss it, because there were enough whites who were alarmed about it also. So in a way, the NAACP sensed that that was a starting point. They had other things on their agenda having to do with housing, education, political involvement, But lynching was something that was so over the top that it was easy for them, in a way, to address.
The NAACP began an anti-lynching campaign in 1909, shortly after it was founded. You write that James Weldon Johnson, the writer, led their anti-lynching legislative effort. How did the NAACP decide that they should try to get federal legislation that would outlaw lynching?
I believe it was probably inspired to a certain degree by the success of both the women's suffrage movement and also prohibition, both of which came in around 1920. And so James Weldon Johnson and the NAACP believed that if the federal government could get involved in people's lives to the extent that they would tell them what they could drink, that they could surely get involved to stop people from burning other human beings alive. So they went ahead with the help of a white congressman named Dyer from St. Louis. And both in the 20s and the 30s, the NAACP mounted several very powerful campaigns in Congress to get a federal anti-lynching law passed.
Now, what approach did Congressman Dyer take in his bill to defining and trying to prevent lynching?
Well, as I said before, the sense was that this was not murder. In other words, there was a constitutional issue in that the southern states pointed out that, first of all, that the federal government had no right to involve itself in local criminal affairs in the South, and that these were just murders, and that the states were perfectly able to take care of them. The federal government, those advocating the federal bill, insisted that this was a different type of crime, that it wasn't just murder, but rather a form of anarchy in which laws were ignored. And so that was really the basis that they used, that they felt it really boiled down to this age-old argument in this country between federal and states' rights. In other words, that were Americans federal citizens who were entitled to protection from the federal government, or were they citizens of the states, and thus criminals were to be dealt with on a local level?
Philip Dre's new book is At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Henry and Edith Everett, recognizing Teach for America, college graduates teaching in under-resourced public schools, 800-TFA-1230. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, creating anti-lynching laws. We continue our conversation with Philip Dre, author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the new recording by saxophonists Plaz Johnson and Red Holloway.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Philip Dre, is the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. He also co-authored the book We Are Not Afraid, about the murder of three civil rights workers in Mississippi in 1964. When we left off, Philip Dre told Terry about the NAACP campaign in the early 20s to promote anti-lynching legislation in Congress with the help of Representative L.C. Dyer of Missouri.
I think this is interesting. You're right that one of the reasons why Congress was finally ready to really listen to this anti-lynching bill was that there was a lot of fear in the North that lynching would follow the black migration to the North and that the North would have trouble.
Yes, that's right. There was a very famous case in 1911 in a town called Coatesville, Pennsylvania. Coatesville was a very typical northern mill town in that it had sent agents into the South to recruit black workers, telling them conditions are much better in Pennsylvania. We have electric lights on the street and there's no Jim Crow and et cetera. What happened, though, is that one of these workers got in a fight with a policeman in Coatesville one night and shot and killed him. What happened basically was that the town of Coatesville behaved just like any other any southern town. This man was taken to a field, set afire. A large crowd watched. Afterward, the North, the New York, Washington, Baltimore, were outraged because this had happened so close by, and there was a flood of editorials and demands that at least here justice will be done. We're not going to be like the South. Well. Instead, the exact same thing happened, which was the locals all stuck together, wouldn't inform on one another, and basically the case was never, they were never able to prosecute it. So it was very shameful and very kind of a wake-up call for the North, really, that this form of violence would follow the migration north, and there were other instances too. There was a famous lynching in Duluth, Minnesota, actually, at one time, one of the northernmost cities in the country.
And the way you describe it, this bill defined lynching as a murder of any citizen in the U.S. by a mob of three or more people. And then the bill sets out to punish people who are complicit in it, like a sheriff or other state officer who failed to make a reasonable effort to keep a prisoner in his custody and prevent them from being lynched. They were going to be punished.
Yes, that was a really that was actually not in the Dyer bill, I don't believe, but it came in what they call the Wagner-Costigan bill. There were several versions of this bill.
I see.
In other words, that was a sophistication of it because what they, the northern congressmen were always trying to make, find a way to make the bill acceptable to the southerners. And one of the things they did eventually was change it so that only lawmen would be held responsible because really that's where, even though obviously lawmen couldn't control every lynching, many of them, lawmen were often complicit in lynchings. And it was believed that especially in like a southern county, say in Alabama or Mississippi, that the sheriff or his deputies basically knew what was going on. And so by placing, putting punishments in place for them, they felt that was the most direct way to inhibit lynching. And indeed, it did work when there were those type of things put in place. For instance, I believe in South Carolina, there was a system where any county where someone was lynched would have to pay a fine of $10,000 to the state. Well, right away, the local police became much more vigilant about protecting lynchings because this was something that was really hitting them where they lived.
So what legislation, what federal legislation was finally passed?
There never was an anti-lynching law passed, actually. They tried many times through the 20s, 30s. The last attempt was during the Second World War. What basically happened is that efforts in Congress eventually just ran out. The Southern bloc was just too strong, and on several occasions they filibustered bills to death. One of the most well-known instances is during the 30s when Franklin Roosevelt, who was, of course, he and Eleanor Roosevelt both were very sympathetic to the work of the NAACP and about lynching, but basically wound up telling the NAACP that they just could not put the important congressional agenda at risk for this one issue because the Southerners would just block all other movement. So that was pretty much the end of it. After during the Second World War, what you see is the federal judiciary kind of picking up the battle. And indeed, that's where it eventually really made more progress. They call that the due process revolution. All during the 20th century, a series of Supreme Court decisions that it incrementally restored to the federal government the right to mandate what constituted a criminal trial and what levels of due process were owed to citizens.
So we can't really credit federal legislation with stopping lynching. What were the main factors that brought that to an end?
Well, lynching was diminishing slowly all along, partly, I believe, through pressure. The NAACP was very successful, really, in that from 1911 or so on, they were publicizing lynchings. They would always do a very thorough job of investigating lynchings so as to get out what they believed was the actual story. In other words, their effort was meant to correct the myths that would surround a lynching typically and try to put out a story that made the victim seem at least somewhat sympathetic and to make the lynch mob appear gross and, out of control, essentially, and irresponsible. So this did take effect in unpopular opinion. You also see in the 20s, for instance, after the First World War, a sense that, in other words, like world events were casting lynching in a different light after what people felt was this barbaric foreign war and, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution. The idea of anarchy was meant a lot to people in America then. The idea that lynch mobs represented anarchy was this thing that could get people very excited. Similarly, in the 30s, you had, with the rise of fascism in Europe, you could place lynching sort of in that context, and so people naturally had this reaction to it that, well, that's not us, that's something that's going on over there. And of course, this was accentuated by the fact that the Nazis would publish pictures of U.S. lynchings and distribute them to show, like, well, here, you know, what are you talking about, basically? You know, this is what you're up to. So you had this kind of larger world influence. Other things, too. In the 30s, a big hot-button crime in the 30s was kidnapping, after the famous Lindbergh kidnapping. There was a sense of unease on the part of people that criminals had become mobile, that, you know, that there were these gangster syndicates and people being abducted. And so in that context, too, lynching then became seen as this kind of atrocious event that just could not be allowed to continue. So those were really the things that kind of diminished it. And after the Second World War in particular, when the U.S., of course, was involved in this global crusade against fascism, lynching became seen as completely anachronistic. And even though lynchings continued to occur, they were always afterward then seen as very like a throwback kind of event and were often covered as such by the press.
You mentioned that the NAACP had a campaign in which they tried to evoke sympathy with the people being lynched and show the people behind the lynchings as the real villains. And you reprint part of an NAACP brochure, I think it's a brochure, in which there's a picture of a lynching and then some writing underneath it. I want you to describe this picture and then read us what's written underneath. This is from 1935.
Right. This is a picture from a lynching of a man named Reuben Stacy in Florida. It was taken on July 19th, 1935. What's striking about the photograph is that it shows in the foreground a young black man wearing overalls who's been hanged. And standing around the tree where he's hanged are a group of people, prominently several young girls who look almost as if they're dressed to go to Sunday school. They're kind of looking up at him. And the text reads, "Do not look at the Negro. His earthly problems are ended. Instead, look at the seven white children who gaze at this gruesome spectacle. Is it horror or gloating on the face of the neatly dressed 7-year-old girl on the right? Is the tiny 4-year-old on the left old enough, one wonders, to comprehend the barbarism her elders have perpetrated? Reuben Stacy, the Negro, who was lynched at Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on July 19, 1935, for, quote, threatening and frightening a white woman, suffered physical torture for a few short hours. But what psychological havoc is being wrought in the minds of the white children?"
Who was this flyer distributed to?
it was probably, knowing the NAACP, it was distributed quite widely. They would almost always distribute to every member of Congress, any other leading political figure they could think of, and, of course, the press. That was always a very important thing for the NAACP and any other reformers, was to turn the press into their supporters because lynching was, for many years, it was very popular journalism. It was what that one academic has called it, folk pornography. In other words, articles about lynchings, because they dealt with such visceral subjects and often had a sexual theme, were sort of like bodice rippers almost. They were very popular and they ran prominently in Southern newspapers. So the NAACP, what they're trying to do here is sort of contradict that, to show images that are sort of telling the other side of the story and, of course, are in their own way very disturbing.
And I think the NAACP is also saying with this picture, white people, these lynchings are bad for you. Look how it's perverting your children.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Yes, that was a theme that increasingly came to the fore. There was a woman from Georgia named Lillian Smith, who's the famous author of the novel Strange Fruit, who wrote extensively about lynching. And yes, that was always a theme that she expounded on a great deal, was that the South ultimately was its own victim of this syndrome.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Philip Dre, and he's written a new history of lynching in the United States called At the Hands of Persons Unknown. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Dre. He's written a new book about the history of lynching in America. It's called At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. I know you're asked this a lot, but what's considered to be the last lynching in America, or the last wave of lynchings?
The last lynching that I mention in the book,
maybe that's a presumptuous question. I mean, maybe there wasn't a last one. You know, maybe it's still happening in some places.
Well, it is a strange, of course, it's not a strange question. It's because lynching itself it's a kind of a fluid idea in a certain way. In other words, some things that we call hate crimes, I suppose now, I mean, there's a certain amount of semantics involved, mm-hmm. Might have 100 years ago been known as lynchings. In the book, what I cite is the last lynching, essentially, and even though I admit that it's just my own, really just a way to focus on one, but the Goodman Schwerner Cheney murder in Mississippi in 1964 was, in a way, I think of it as the last lynching, because for a couple of reasons. One, it was a classic lynching in that it involved the victims being arrested, held by the police until the lynch mob was ready, and then released to a lynch mob. So that's a very kind of classic form. In that case, what makes it so important is that was the case where the federal government finally said, okay, we're going to go and try to make it so that we'll have laws that we can prosecute lynch mobs. And so that case became one in which the Justice Department went to the Supreme Court and raised basically two old Reconstruction era criminal statutes that have to do with civil rights conspiracy. These statutes had kind of been dormant for decades, but because, like a lot of Reconstruction-era law, they'd been sort of defanged and ignored or set aside. So what the Justice Department set out to do was to restore them, put the teeth back in them. And essentially that's what happened, because the state of Mississippi thought the crime was a hoax and would not even investigate it. So there were no murder charges. So it was up to the federal government to bring the case, which they felt they had to, because it was such a huge case. It was sort of a national preoccupation in the late 60s. And so that's what happened. They succeeded in 1967 in convicting the lynch mob in the Goodman, Schroeder, and Cheney case under these federal statutes of violating the civil rights of the three victims. So in a way, that was a kind of a, I mentioned before, the idea of the due process revolution. In other words, this was a kind of a landmark in that it was a victory for the federal government in restoring their ability to go after lynch mobs.
And I want to remind our listeners that you're the author of an earlier book on the Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman lynchings. And you call those lynchings, even though they're not, hangings.
That's right, because even though that's the most popular image of a lynching, lynchings could involve any kind of, they often involve shootings or burnings as well. So really the lynching aspect of it has to do more with the activity of the mob, often in cahoots with the law, rather than the actual form of execution.
Philip Dre, I'm wondering, there's no photograph of you on the dust jacket for your new book about lynching, and I'm wondering why.
I didn't know you'd ask me that. I guess I didn't put a photo on just because I thought maybe it would be better if people, when picking up the book, didn't think in terms of the race of the author.
I had a feeling that's what it was about. Are you white?
I'm
in Philadelphia and you're in New York, so we're not seeing each other. So
yes,
I don't know
I
for sure what, you know, if you're black or white.
No, I am. Well, when I wrote the other book about the Goodman, Schroeder, Cheney case and did some author promotion for that, I was always very pleased. There was no photo on that book either, and I was always very pleased to show up at radios or radio stations or whatever and have people say, oh, I thought you were black, or I didn't know what you'd be. And I kind of enjoyed that they had looked at the book and not really known for certain, because I didn't want that to be a distraction and for someone to prejudge it and say, oh, well, this, I know what this will be like. This is, you know, one thing or another.
Were you concerned that your book might seem less credible to some people because it's perceived as an African-American issue and you're a white author, you're a white journalist?
That's part of it, I think. For me, it's like a double trespass, really, because not only am I white, but I'm not a professor. I'm just really like a freelance writer. And so I feel in a way a little bit like I like to be very cautious because I don't have a lot of credentials in the field except for the other book that I wrote. I'm just like an enthusiast, really. I enjoy this researching and writing about this particular type of history. I think also for me, too, with both of these books, this one in particular, you can't work on a book like this without having the sense a little bit that you're more the messenger, really, than the author, because the subject itself is so overwhelming and it's so painful that you almost have this sense that you want to get out of the way a little bit and just let the story come through and not, you know, sort of wave a flag yourself so much. And it's not so much about, you know, I'm the author, this is my book, this is my statement or something like that, but rather, here's this story, and I'm glad to bring it to you.
Well, Philip Dre, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Philip Dre is the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America.
Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crow. to pluck for the rain together, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here is a strange and bitter crop.
Billie Holiday, recorded in 1946. Coming up, a review of the new album from saxophonist Plaz Johnson and Red Holloway. This is Fresh Air. A new album pairs up Southern California saxophonists Plaz Johnson and Red Holloway. Johnson grew up in New Orleans, toured with bluesmen Charles Brown and Johnny Otis in the 1950s, and has spent much of his professional life in recording studios, backing jazz and pop musicians, and playing tenor saxophone on the original Pink Panther theme. Holloway came up in Chicago, toured with jazz organists Jack McDuff and Bill Doggett, and spent 5 years jousting on stage with fellow saxophonist Sonny Stitt. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of their new album, but first here's Plaz Johnson and Red Holloway on the latter's tune, Brethren.
Jazz values spontaneity, of course. And yet, some of the jazz records that get the least recognition and respect are informal sessions that call for little rehearsal, counting on the musicians to make it work on the spot. This is by no means a foolproof method, but sometimes it works out quite well. So it goes with a new disc by Plaz Johnson and Red Holloway, whose title is their plan of action, Keep That Groove Going. As tenor saxophonists, they're evenly matched and similarly down-to-earth, with just enough contrast between their sounds. Plaz Johnson often favors a hard-edged tone and punchy phrasing. Plaz Johnson with Kenny Washington on drums. Compared to Johnson, Red Holloway has a deeper, warmer tone on tenor sax. This is from his feature, Serenade in Blue. The organist is Gene Ludwig. ¶¶ That organ and tenor combination sounds lifted from a 40-year-old Blue Note record, a good old sound with a lot of the sanctified church in it. Saxophonists aside, the dominant voice here is the guitar of Melvin Sparks, under-celebrated linchpin of umpteen soul jazz records like this one. He's particularly strong on bluesy material, where his spiky tone makes him sound more like a real blues man than a jazz guitarist. A session like Keep That Groove Going, which is on Milestone, confirms the restorative power of the blues served straight up. Records led by two tenor saxophonists usually get tagged as tenor battles, but what these guys do is more like friendly sparring. The idea is not to draw blood, but enjoy the workout and maybe pick up a move or two. Nobody tries too hard or too little. Their repertoire of blues, ballads, and shouts avoids the usual jam session warhorses, and the project calls attention to fine players well worth your notice. That's more than a lot of highfalutin jazz does.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Keep That Groove Going, featuring saxophonists Plaz Johnson and Red Holloway. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Dialogues of the Dead by Reginald Hill, a novel of British psychological suspense, and by Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, why Carrie dumped her boyfriend. We talk about that and other new plot twists with Michael Patrick King, the executive producer of HBO's Sex and the City. Join us for the next Fresh Air.